May it please the court, my name is Anastasia Wade, and I represent the appellate Kyle Lukas. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. This is an appeal about the district court's premature dismissal of a complaint based solely on the legal arguments included as opposed to the asserted facts. The facts of this case are simple, and as this is an appeal of a motion to dismiss, the facts of this case come solely from the complaint filed pro se by Kyle Lukas. Those facts are assumed to be true. For purposes of this appeal, there are three relevant and uncontested facts asserted in the complaint which state a claim over which a federal district court would have jurisdiction. First, the government failed to issue notice of deficiency to Kyle Lukas prior to assessing taxes against him. Second, the government filed liens on Lukas's property. Third, Lukas's notified the government that the liens were unenforceable due to procedural defects, and the government failed to release the lien. These three facts support claims under 28 U.S.C. Section 2410 and 26 U.S.C. Section 7432.
What about the venue problem?
Venue, we agree that the venue was wrong. We think that it should be transferred to the Eastern District of Michigan.
Have you asked for transfer before?
No.
So why don't we just dismiss it for lack of venue? If both sides agree there's no venue, I guess the question is, what are we doing here?
What we're doing here is the district court didn't dismiss it for venue. They dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction and failure.
Should we dismiss it for lack of venue?
I think we would be okay with that as long as we reverse the dismissal for failure to state a claim and lack of jurisdiction. The district court below, in its analysis,
well, there's nothing left of the case. We don't have to hear any more argument. Right?
Then we're going to have a reversal of the dismissal for failure to state a claim and lack of jurisdiction.
Dismiss for lack of venue, period.
I mean, that would certainly solve the issue, but we would need a reversal of the failure to state a claim and the district court didn't just say that there is a lack of venue. They said that there is a failure to state a claim and a lack of subject matter jurisdiction so that no court would have jurisdiction over this case. Mm. And that's mainly what our appeal is about. We prefer to be transferred to the Eastern District of Michigan.
Well, if you preferred it, why didn't you say that in the brief? I mean, it seems a little late to be asking now for a transfer if everybody agrees there's no venue here. The court has two choices, to dismiss or to transfer. But what's the grounds for the transfer as compared to dismissal?
The grounds for transfer is that he has stated a claim over which a district court would have jurisdiction. And unfortunately, the district court in this case dismissed it for lack of jurisdiction and failure to state a claim.
Would you have statute of limitations problems if it were dismissed as opposed to transferred?
No. The statute of limitations problem raised by the government in their appellate brief as the 7432, they based on the same reasons for 7433 statute of limitations issues. The two claims are different.
But I think what Judge Kavanaugh is asking, if we dismiss and you file now in the correct place, isn't the time up? Isn't it now too late for you to file?
Yes, it would be.
So you need a transfer?
We do need a transfer.
Good.
All right. The district court below, in its analysis on the motion to dismiss, overlooked the facts of the complaint and instead improperly focused its analysis on the legal arguments and rhetoric contained in the complaint. In accordance with the Supreme Court's recent decisions in Bell Atlantic Corp v. Twombly and Ashcroft v. Iqbal, the legal arguments included in the complaint are irrelevant and not to be considered in a motion to dismiss. The facts of the complaint are to be the focus of the analysis. The district court based its dismissal on Lukas's arguments and legal reasoning instead of the facts. According to the district court, Lukas asserted a claim based on the facts of his complaint, but was over-inclusive by including tax protester-like rhetoric in the complaint. This over-inclusion was the district court's justification for dismissal. A complaint should not be dismissed for over-inclusion, especially a pro se complaint. The district court's dismissal of all counts at this stage in the case was premature. The facts in this complaint raise procedural errors in the government's assessment and enforcement of taxes against Lacus. Lacus's complaint alleges that the government never issued the notices of deficiency. Without issuing the notice of deficiency, the government is not allowed to assess taxes, levy property, or file a collection action in the district court under 26 U.S.C. section 6213. Because Lacus alleged that the government failed to issue a notice of deficiency, the government was not allowed to assess taxes against Lacus, thus rendering the tax assessment invalid. The tax liens on Lacus's property are based on the tax assessment. Because the tax assessment is invalid, the tax liens are invalid. The notice of deficiency is the first step in the process and the first statutorily mandated interface between the government and the taxpayer. The failure to issue the notice of deficiency is a procedural error. The procedure for creating a tax lien on property is, first, the IRS mails the notice of deficiency to the taxpayer's last known address by certified or registered mail. The taxpayers have 90 days after the mailing of the notice to file a petition for redetermination in the tax court.
I take you back a second. You said the district court did not dismiss for lack of venue?
Correct. They dismissed for failure to state a claim and lack of jurisdiction.
I'm looking at the district court's opinion. It says the court finds that your client has failed to rebut and thereby conceded defendant's argument that venue is improper.
That was the district court's first part of the decision.
That was what?
That was the district court's first part of the decision. Then they went on to dismiss for failure to state a claim and lack of jurisdiction.
No, that dealt with the question of transfer. The dismissal was for lack of venue.
The dismissal was for lack of venue, lack of jurisdiction, and failure to state a claim.
And then the next sentence is, upon evaluation of your client's substantive claims, the court finds transfer in lieu of dismissal is not in the interest of justice.
Correct, because the district court found that there was a failure to state a claim and a lack of jurisdiction over the claim.
Isn't that the alternative ruling? That's the third sentence after the one judge. Judge Randolph's read the first two sentences of the conclusion, and the third one says, alternatively, to the extent that venue may be proper, the court finds dismissal is appropriate because of lack of subject matter jurisdiction.
Right.
So the primary ruling is the one that Judge Randolph just suggested, which is that there's no venue and that, therefore, dismissal is proper. Is that wrong?
The first part was there's no venue. Mm-hmm. The transfer issue was that the district court felt they did not need to transfer it because there was a failure to state a claim and a lack of jurisdiction. Therefore, we couldn't file in the Eastern District of
Michigan.
Your
client never requested a transfer.
Correct. He was a pro se litigant. Mm-hmm. The failure to issue a notice of deficiency is a procedural error. The procedure for creating a tax lien involves, first, the IRS mailing the notice of deficiency by certified mail to the taxpayer's last known address. The taxpayer then has 90 days after the mailing of the notice of deficiency to request redetermination before the tax court. If the taxpayer does not file within 90 days, the IRS may assess taxes. After the assessment, within 60 days, the IRS mails a notice and demand for payment to the taxpayer, specifying the amount due and demanding payment. Fourth and finally, if the taxpayer does not pay, the IRS may issue a notice of intent to levy property or to file a lien on property and then file liens on the taxpayer's property.
Can I ask you a question about the meaning of 7432? So that's one of the two statutes you're relying on, right?
Correct.
So that one says you can bring a civil suit if the IRS fails to release a lien under 6325.
Correct.
And then 6325 says that the secretary shall issue a release within 30 days after the secretary finds that the liability for the amount assessed has been fully satisfied or has become legally unenforceable, right?
Correct.
The secretary hasn't found that, right, with respect to your client?
We don't know that at this point. In this point in the complaint, we have no idea.
Well, you don't even allege that the secretary found that it was legally unenforceable. In fact, you're complaining that the secretary didn't find it legally unenforceable, right?
We're complaining that the secretary did not release the liens.
Well, you have to, but that's not enough, right? In order to make a cause of action under 6325 and 7432, it's not that the secretary didn't release. It didn't. It's that the secretary didn't release under 6325, right?
Correct.
And to be required to release under 6325, the secretary has to have found that the lien has become legally unenforceable. Right.
As to have knowingly or negligently failed to release the lien.
That's not what it says. It says the secretary finds that the liability has become legally unenforceable. The secretary has never made that finding with respect to your client.
I see that I'm going to my rebuttal time.
I guess you have a choice. You can answer the question or you can save time for rebuttal. Which would you prefer?
I'd like to save time for rebuttal.
All right.
Thank you.
We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Janet Bradley. I'm with the U.S. Department of Justice Tax Division, and I represent the United States in this appeal. I'd first like to address Judge Garland's question about the venue. Here, the government had asserted that venue was improper in the District of Columbia here because at the time the complaint was filed, the taxpayer lived in Michigan, and all of the alleged wrongful tax collection occurred in Michigan. So the government brought this to the court's attention, and we accordingly, in our motion to dismiss, one of the grounds for dismissing it was for lack of venue. The venue statute, 28 U.S.C. 1402, provides that the district court shall dismiss when venue is improper, or if it's in the interest of justice, go ahead and decide the case. And here, what the district court did was acknowledge.
Say that again. Go ahead and decide the case. You didn't mean that, did you?
No. Has jurisdiction to determine whether or not to transfer it.
Yeah.
If venue is improper, the court shall dismiss, or if in the interest of justice, not dismiss and dismiss it on. Here it was for lack of jurisdiction.
Well, that's not what the statute says. The statute says dismiss or, in the interest of justice, transfer.
Transfer.
It doesn't say decide the case.
The court's decisions addressing this have found that it's not proper to transfer a case to another court if the determination is made that no district court would have subject matter over the case. So on the facts here, the district court decided venue being improper, it took a peek of the merits in this case and determined that it was not in the interest of justice to transfer because there was no jurisdiction in this district court or any district court over the taxpayer's two causes of action.
But on one of the causes of action, there's a circuit split, correct?
That is correct.
And the Sixth Circuit has not opined on it, correct?
Correct.
So how can we be sure that the Sixth Circuit wouldn't agree with the Third Circuit on that question?
Well, we would hope that this court, as the Sixth Circuit, we would present the argument that the decisions of the Ninth Circuit and Elias and the Tenth Circuit and Guthrie addressing the specific
shouldn't
issue.
Shouldn't we let the Sixth Circuit decide that in the first instance? If venue's proper there, it's hard to say it's so frivolous that no court would be able to address the claims.
I mean, we know that some district courts do have jurisdiction to address the claims because their circuits have said so.
Again, we would like to redirect the focus here that the district court, in looking at the claim here, the plaintiff had a number of causes of action in his complaint, and here the primary thrust of his arguments was that his wages were not income, that the compensation he received for his labor was not taxable, and on the facts there, which he repeated over and over again through his complaint, and in addition, in the attachment, which is Exhibit A, Again, the main thrust of the plaintiff's complaint here was there was no proper assessment.
What about the non-main thrust of the complaint?
Well,
again, we don't usually dismiss a complaint just because the main thrust is deficient if there's some part of it that's not.
Again, here the district court, looking at the complaint in the totality of the circumstances, thought that the main thrust of his complaint was the assessment. And indeed, once the government moved to dismiss, when the taxpayer here did file a response to our motion to dismiss, taxpayer again didn't focus the court's attention on a missing notice of deficiency. The response again focused on the fact that liens were invalid because he didn't have a tax liability, because he did not believe that his wages were taxable income. So on the circumstances here, again, the district court wasn't really...
Why isn't sufficient for the district court to just look at the complaint and say, look, this is off the wall. I mean, this is totally frivolous. And it looks to me like what this fellow is trying to do is attack his tax liability, which is really improper here anyway. And regardless whether we have jurisdiction or not, it's not in the interest of justice to transfer this frivolous lawsuit. Why do you have to go to the – did the government argue anything other than lack of jurisdiction in – when the government – when you filed your venue motion, you argued that it would not be in the interest of justice to transfer it. And the plaintiff never opposed that. But was the argument against transfer solely on the basis of subject matter jurisdiction? Was there anything else that the government said?
Again, the taxpayer's complaint here had a 13-count complaint, so that the two remaining issues on appeal, which are quiet title in count one and damages for failure to release, I believe they're in count eight and nine. Insofar as those two, the district court, it got to lack of jurisdiction because there was no appropriate waiver of sovereign immunity that the plaintiff did not allege.
Did the government, in saying it's not in the interest of justice to transfer this, did the government argue anything other than lack of jurisdiction?
Insofar as the other claims, we also moved to dismiss for failure to state a claim under 12b-6. So our motion was lack of venue, lack of jurisdiction, and failure to state a claim. But the government here did point out that the taxpayer's complaint, the whole bottom line of his complaint was that he did not believe that his wages were taxable income. The taxpayer here hadn't filed federal income tax returns for a number of years. And as a result of that, the IRS...
Here's what I'm driving at. If you go to page 141 of the joint appendix I read from and Judge Garland read from, the second sentence in the conclusion does not look to me like a sentence that is dealing with subject matter jurisdiction. It looks to me like the judge is saying, look, this claim on the merits looks frivolous to me. But upon evaluation of the plaintiff's substantive claims, the court finds transfer in lieu of dismissal is not in the interest of justice. Sounds like a discretionary judgment on the part of the court, and one that the plaintiff has not opposed.
That is correct. The district court's decision not to transfer would be a discretionary determination.
Just end it right there.
Well, honestly, that probably would have been the preferable outcome, but I do think that the district court here, just out of an abundance of caution, so that there was no doubt, went on to address each and every one of the taxpayers' allegations. Obviously, the court could have just decided that it was a frivolous lawsuit and in its discretion could have stopped right there.
The second sentence?
Okay. Absolutely could have stopped here. Again, the district court seemed just to be exhaustively thorough just to make sure that all of the allegations that it could see that plaintiff was making regarding his inability to have a tax liability were properly addressed. So if there's any reassurance in that to show that, in fact, there was no merit to any of his allegations, the district court addressed all of them.
Has the government made any representation about whether there was a deficiency notice?
In this case, there's nothing in the record to indicate whether a deficiency notice was or was not issued. And in fact, just given the procedural posture of this case, since our motion to dismiss was filed before we filed an answer, we never addressed that. So here again, insofar as he's alleging no notice of deficiency, we would allege that again is an allegation that goes to a pre-assessment activity, the validity of the assessment, which even as appellant's counsel concedes in their brief, they can't go to the assessment, that would not be a proper allegation to be made either in a quiet title action or under 7432. So here we feel that the district court exhaustively addressed everything. Venue was not proper. That was something that was never addressed. I mean, in fact, the taxpayer here conceded that venue was improper. And that being said, the district court could have just ended the matter there, and it would not have been abuse of discretion to decide not to transfer.
What would happen to count one in the Third Circuit?
Count one with quiet title in the Third Circuit. Third Circuit's dispositive decision in this regard is the Robinson case. Under Robinson, the Court of Appeals held there that the failure to receive a notice of deficiency was a procedural error that could be addressed in a Section 24 quiet title suit. Again, we would say this case is just as a first, is factually distinguishable. In Robinson, the taxpayer admitted the liability, did not challenge that the taxes were due and owing, which we believe is appropriate. And number two, in Robinson, the government...
I'm not sure why that first one's relevant.
The first one's relevant because, again, in all of the cases addressing 2410, the taxpayers can't challenge their liability. They can't use it to do an end run around their existing judicial remedies, either vis-a-vis a deficiency suit in the tax court or a refund action in the district court. That would be the significance we would attach to that.
You had a second.
And the second point in Robinson is the government did concede on the record that a notice of deficiency was not sent. So here there's nothing in the record that a deficiency notice wasn't in fact
sent.
Right,
but at this stage, as you correctly pointed out just a few moments ago, we have to accept that because no answer was filed, right?
Correct. Under a 12B1 motion, the court is supposed to liberally construe the allegations and assume the correctness.
You don't have to liberally.
And to assume the correctness. Assume the correctness. Again, that being said, the conclusion whether or not a notice of deficiency goes to assessment, which we believe is the correct approach, vis-a-vis collection, is a legal conclusion, so that the district court was not obliged to accept his allegation that a notice of deficiency was properly raised in a quiet title suit.
Just out of curiosity, would there have been an action under the Anti-Injunction Act exception under 6213, or does that have to come before?
The taxpayer here under 6213, there is an exception to the Anti-Injunction Act for purposes of suits where a notice of deficiency is not issued not sent to a taxpayer's last known address prior to the assessment being made. That admittedly would have been a remedy here that the taxpayer could have pursued.
But wasn't in the complaint, and it's not.
But wasn't in the complaint, and again, on appeal here, counsel does not point out any error in that regard. And one other point the government made in their brief with respect to Robinson in an effort to distinguish not only on the facts what happened there, but also as a legal matter, at the time Robinson was decided, and I believe that was in 1992, the taxpayers did not have the availability of collection due process rights. In fact, Congress in 1998, I think probably seeing that there was an issue for taxpayers to address some collection procedures, enacted Section 6320 and 6330 of the Internal Revenue Code, which allows taxpayers to have notice before a lien is filed, before we levy, and then the tax...
How would we use an after enacted statute to interpret what Congress meant in enacting 7432. How would that give us any idea about that? I think your argument is that it couldn't have been part of the lien statute because the quiet title statute because there's another alternative.
Well, again,
there wasn't another alternative at the time.
Absolutely, and that's probably a lot of the reason why some of those quiet title cases were decided, because at that time there didn't seem to be a clear-cut remedy aside from a taxpayer paying the tax. They always had the availability of a refund suit, but there didn't seem to be necessarily a remedy available to taxpayers to challenge a lien on their property. That seemed to be the genesis of these 2410 cases. And now, again, for cases arising subsequent to the Internal Revenue Restructuring Act of 98, enacting these CDP provisions, just an assurance that taxpayers do, there is a remedy for the taxpayers, so that quiet title is not necessarily the exclusive means. Just would like to sum up that we feel that the government, that the district court here properly dismissed this complaint for lack of jurisdiction, correctly observed that venue was not proper, and on that basis we would ask this court to affirm the decision. And if the court decides to dismiss for basis of improper venue, we would ask the court to dismiss with prejudice. Thank you.
Let me just pause over that last thing. If we don't say with prejudice, the statute of limitations issue would still run. So what's the difference?
The difference would be that taxpayer just couldn't refile the instant action.
Well, on what ground could we say dismiss with prejudice? If the only ground is lack of jurisdiction, how do we dismiss on any ground other than lack of jurisdiction? Lack of venue.
At this point, I believe the statute of limitations has run on filing a suit, so that would actually just put an end to it going before another district court.
Okay. Hearing no further questions,
thank you
very much. Ms. Wade. Does Ms. Wade have any time left?
I would first like to address the question that was posed right before I left for rebuttal on the 6325 mm-hmm. issue, or 6432 issue. If you look at the statute, section 7432, it says that if the government knowingly or negligently fails to release the lien. In this case, Lacus said that he put the government on notice that the lien was unenforceable, therefore implying that the government had knowledge that the lien was unenforceable and the government did not release the lien.
Which is the subsection you're talking about?
Section 7432.
Where's the knowingly part? Knowingly or by reason? Right, but it still says knowingly or by reason of negligence fails to release a lien under 6325, which
right.
still drives us back to the question of what does 6325 mean?
6325 is when the government knows that the lien is unenforceable and needs to release it.
Well, my problem, I'm not saying you're wrong, I just don't know. The words are it's not what 6325 says. It just says when the secretary finds that the liability has become legally unenforceable.
Correct.
Are there cases that interpret that as simply meaning when it is unenforceable rather than when the secretary finds? Because if you read it, you know.
Correct.
If you read it strictly, it doesn't happen until after the secretary makes a finding.
Correct. I think at this point in the case, it's too early to determine whether the secretary made that finding or not. I think there's allegations that the secretary did, that imply that the secretary did and failed to release it. But at this point in the case, at the complaint stage, it's too early to determine that.
Okay. Thanks.
With respect to Robinson, we believe that Robinson is directly on point with this case. I know the government brought up the fact that there was the legal rhetoric of the tax protester-like rhetoric in the complaint. However, the complaint still has facts that state that there was no notice of deficiency. And in fact, the district court noticed in the opposition of Lacus that he abandoned the idea that this is a substantive claim and focused solely on the procedural errors and the tax lien. Again, much like Robinson, or like in Kulawi v. U.S., where the taxpayer in the beginning had tech processor-like complaints, but then abandoned them later on. In this case, we have the same thing. Because Lacus has alleged facts under which a district court would have jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. Section 2410 and 26 U.S.C. Section 7432, we ask that you reverse the district court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under submission.